Accession number 4486, Reel 2.
Colonel King Clark, Reel 2. Were there any special problems in Egypt with keeping your troops from getting bored? Any special problems with man management, in other words?
I think that this was a perennial problem in the British Army abroad. Looking back now, particularly with sort of liberal ideas on sex that obtain, and by liberal I mean the fact that men and women need each other. One of the things that really astounds me, looking back, and this goes much further back than just Egypt, of course, in 1936 or 37, or whatever it was, is the way in which you had these large numbers of healthy young men in places like Ismailia, Egypt, and in India, who had no access to women really at all, except possibly in brothels were not allowed. This doesn't matter me talking about brothels, of course, were not permitted by the British government. I forget who it was, a famous lady who stuck her oar in whenever this was raised in Parliament. But this was really the only access that the men had to women. In Egypt, I remember, in Ismailia, I think it was rather different, because Egypt was a protectorate or a mandate, or anyway, whatever it was. It wasn't a colony or a dominion. This rule was, I think, rather relaxed, and there was, in fact, a brothel in Ismailia. I know, I'm trying to remember what they called it, or even exactly where it was, but it was sort of across the railway somewhere, to which I think was medically inspected at regular intervals by the MOs, and I think the men had access to this, which I think was quite different to later when I served in India and Singapore and places like that, where men went to these places, but of course there was no supervision. There was, in all regiments at that time, it was one of the, again, one of the perennial problems. There was always quite a high instance of VD, and one of the and of course it was a man, if he caught VD, it was a self-inflicted wound, so to speak, and he was treated. The wards in the hospital dealing with VD patients were always made particularly unpleasant for them. One knew this as an officer because each week, of course, you went to pay out your men of your company in hospital, and it generally included a few in the VD ward, so you saw, as a young officer paying out, you saw the sort of conditions in which they had their treatment. But this was always one of the, and very often regiments that had too high an instance of VD were wrapped thoroughly over the knuckles by higher commands. This is one of the things I was always trying to stop, and always the ways in which to prevent this, preventive treatment and so on. But of course the treatment itself in those days was very long. It took them away for about 6 weeks to 3 months, something like that, and that meant you lost a man or 2 or 3 months, probably. So this is one of the aspects of boredom, that sort of one of their ways round boredom, which often got them into trouble.
So what could be done to get their mind off?
Well, it was the old sort of idea that you work them pretty hard, and the usual British cure, but they play. You encourage them to play as many games as they could, and they were the usual. There wasn't any sort of wide range of physical pastimes. Not like today. You know, you can ski and canoe and do everything. It was just the traditional ones of hockey and which was played a lot in the Middle East and in India, of course. And football, soccer, and swimming. And this really, it was limited to this sort of thing. And then there was the nappy, of course. They got very little pay, and they had a night out in the nappy sort of once a week. Generally by Monday they didn't have a pay to their names. But this is really, and a lot of the time they did what a lot of young people do today anyway. I know, 'cause I've got children. they laid in their beds in the barrack rooms and looked at the ceiling or slept. If you went into the barrack room during off-duty hours, almost any time you'd find sort of, you know, a proportion of the men there lying on their backs, looking up at the ceiling or chatting or asleep. Or this was a sort of, they didn't have anywhere else. There were no, probably very few chairs in the barrack, only hard chairs. They just lay on their beds.
Were the troops permitted to go outside the cantonment to have a look at the local towns and the sites?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were allowed out, and they were allowed out just on day passes. Had to be back. They had to be back by 11 o'clock, I think. They were allowed to walk out in the evenings, yes, and go down to the bazaar or whatever it was, or the local village and shop. There were two shops in Izmir, not very many. Exactly the same arrangement as at home. I mean, in Strensel, for instance, they'd go walk out, go to York town if they wanted, or there was no restriction, except they had to be back by a certain time, unless they were on some form of punishment, like CB, of course, in which case they weren't allowed out and had to report it certain times of the day to the guardroom.
Could they go out and see the sites, like the pyramids?
Well, of course, pyramids were a long way away from Izmir, but they could do, and but they weren't particularly enterprising. The average soldier was not particularly enterprising. I don't think the officer was particularly enterprising. I wouldn't think, I don't know. Some were. Money was, you see, really a great sort of restrictor of activities. If you were lucky enough to have some money, then you probably could do a great deal more. But the average pay, money available to anybody in the army, soldier to CO, really limited, town commander limited them to what they could do, unless they had private means.
What about time? Could they get, you said a group of soldiers wanted to go off to see the pyramids, which obviously would require a few days to get there. Mm. Could they get the time off to do it?
I never remember anyone, ever, any soldier, ever wanting to go off from Izmir to Cairo to see the pyramids or to see any archaeological things of archaeological interest at all. I don't think, and I may be wrong, but I'm not being to be sort of superior in any way in this, but I don't think that they were interested in this sort of thing. I don't think they read very much, or I think they were very limited in their interests. And I think if they'd had a chance of going to Cairo, they'd much rather have gone out and, you know, gone into a pub or a cafe and sat there drinking. They would go to look at the pyramids.
What were relations like between the British troops and the Egyptians at the time?
Well, I think exactly the same as they were throughout the world, that the British person thought he was vastly superior to any to any other person in the world, and he treated him with a sort of very, very sort of friendly sort of condescension. They got on fine, because the British soldier gets on very well with anybody. And of course he knew that if he shouted loudly enough, the other fellow would understand what he was saying. And they had picked up this extraordinary sort of smattering of the local language always, a certain sort of key words, you know. I don't think they had a very good opinion of the Egyptians, but they treated them with a very friendly condescension. This is what it was, exactly the same as they did in India, the Indians, and throughout the world.
Was there about the Egyptians which made them not have a very good opinion of them?
I think they thought they were. I think they were lazy, but a lazy race, I think. But then, of course, they were extremely poor, and they probably weren't very well fed, and they didn't get much energy. There was a good deal of disease about, I know, particularly in the Nile Delta and around there, because there was this awful scourge, I think, of Bill Hart's here, wasn't this sort of worm-bred disease, which I think was very debilitating. I think they were pretty low physically, a lot of them. And they I think that the average fellaheen, Egyptian fellaheen, lived on sort of just about subsistence level, you know. So, and if there was a bad harvest, or the Nile didn't, you know, produce enough water, then they were in real trouble. And as usual in those countries, there were great, if you went to Cairo, there were tremendous extremes of wealth and poverty, as I think there are today, probably, in so many of those countries. Very wealthy Egyptians and some extremely poor Egyptians.
How did that type of thing strike the troops? These class differences in Egypt.
These extremes.
Class differences, yeah.
I think that they accepted it exactly the same way they accepted the class differences in British society. I think that I've often wondered about this myself, because I feel quite strongly about it. It's always amazed me that they did accept this. But it was a very stable society, you see. It was very stable. And in fact, I think that they really, again, I may be quite wrong, but I think that they liked their officers to have a certain amount of style and occasionally to do stupid things, and, you know, it gave them a sort of a bit of interest, I think, in a way, because it was a pretty dull life for them. But then if they'd been at home, they would have been going to the mill or the factory or the farm.
Were there any political disturbances in Egypt whilst you were there?
No, not that I remember. I'm quite sure there weren't.
Did you feel that you would have to stand by in support of the civil power?
Not in Ismailia. Ismailia was a very small town, and with a very strong military garrison for the defence of the canal and in fact, we never had any trouble at all. Yeah, that was most unlikely it would be. It was really a military cantonment, you see. In Cairo, the Essex Regiment we were talking about, they were in Cairo. They were at the Citadel in Cairo, if I remember rightly. They may well have had... They were never called out in aid of the civil power, now, I'm quite sure. But they would be more, you know, in a very large Egyptian community. One job I had in Egypt, I just remembered it, which was quite a pleasant job. There was one subaltern was sent up to Port Said to command the guard there. There was I think it was about 30 men, and we had to mount a guard every day on the Navy House, the coal storage plant, and one other place I've forgotten. And we used to mount these the guard. The troops lived in Navy House, which is on the edge of the canal in Port Said. And every morning I used to go and mount the guard on the quay outside Navy House. These three guards, and they marched away. And then it was my job to visit them once by day and once by night. I think it wasn't very arduous. And I lived in the hotel, I forget the name of the hotel now, Continental Hotel or something, you know, the one on the corner of the breakwater through which the entrance to the canal, just by Lesseps' statue. And I just lived in the hotel and went out, mounted the guard in the morning, and I was the only officer there. That's about 60 miles from Ismailia, I suppose. Yes, about halfway down the canal. And it was really pretty boring. And all I did was I used to go and swim and go around, visit the guard, and that was about it. I did that for about a month, I think.
You pointed out that the role of the cantonment at Muasker was for the defence of the canal, should that be necessary. At that time, was it thought by you and your brother officers that any specific world power was any threat to either the specific British position in Egypt or the British Empire at large?
The British position in Egypt, we had certainly thought that Italy was interested in Egypt. During the Abyssinian War, when you remember sanctions were imposed on Italy by Britain and France, I think it was, and in fact, the previous year before I arrived, the whole of the, well, I say the defence of the canal, I think traditionally Muasca was there as a relic of the First War, when the Turks had come across Sinai and had tried to cross the canal, you remember, and it was thought possibly that, I suppose, this is the way the direction in which the threat would lie in the future, possibly, and so and the barracks were there, and they stayed there. In 1936, when the Abyssinian War started, and the Italians built up their forces in Libya and Tripoli, I think it was really felt that war might start between Italy and Britain. And I'd been through Italy quite a bit. I told you, the previous winter I'd spent in Capri and in Naples and Rome, and there was beginning to be an slight anti-British feeling at that time. I felt when I was in Capri, staying in Capri during that winter.
How did it show itself?
Well, I remember in Capri there was a broadcast by Mussolini when we were sitting, Jack Churchill and I were sitting in the piazza, the little piazza there, and everybody came down to listen to this broadcast by Mussolini, and I remember sensing that people were sort of looking at us because he was talking about sanctions. I don't speak Italian, but I spoke enough to understand this. And they were sort of looking around at us, and sort of I could sense that they were sort of being. But the Italians are pretty. I don't think they felt it very deeply. They got worked up about it, and they forgot about it the next day. They were chatting away to you. But I think there was a certain feeling against the British at that time because of the sanctions. There were a lot of notices up in Rome, and saying down with sanctions and so on. And the British and the French for imposing them, this sort of thing. But during the winter of 1936, when I was recovering from this airplane thing, this airplane crash, almost the whole of the Egyptian the garrison in Egypt, and I think there were probably four battalions, there was guards. Battalion in Kazran Hill Barracks in Cairo, and then there was a battalion in the Citadel in Cairo, and there were two battalions in Ismailia, and I think that was a lot, so it would be a sort of brigade, you might say, plus I think it was a tank, whatever it was called in those days, a tank battalion of the Royal Tank Regiment, that I know there was, with Crusader tanks, I think they were called, they were an early cruiser tank. During the Troubles, the whole lot moved out to Mersmatru, and they dug defensive positions the whole of that winter, because I wasn't there, thank goodness, because when I arrived soon after they got back, and they really disliked it out there. It was very, very bad during that winter with incessant sandstorms. They were digging defences which were filled in immediately. They dug them when it was a sandstorm. They were burying petrol. In those days, petrol was supplied in 4-gallon cans,4-gallon cans, very thin sides, not like a jerry can, and you just punctured them and poured the petrol out. And enormous quantities of this was buried, I know, because I remember this is one of the things everybody was complaining about when they got back, and I arrived burying this damn petrol. And I believe that later on, when they went to dig this out, it had all evaporated, and there was no petrol left in the cans anyway. This was when they began to think about going out there with the real war coming up. Anyway, the Abyssinian War finished without conflict between Italy and ourselves, and everybody was withdrawn from Mersma True area, and which of course was beyond the Alamein line, which nobody'd even heard of in those days. I think Mersma True was pretty indefensible anyway, that area. They came back and the whole thing just settled down very quickly. I mean, very quickly. Because when I got out there, people were grumbling about being in the desert, but they didn't really seem to have... And people always say nowadays, when I read a lot, and particularly about that sort of time, and I read again and again that everybody knew there was a war coming. And even at Munich, I don't remember feeling that there was a war definitely coming, and I don't think my fellow officers felt the war was coming necessarily. I suppose if one had been cleverer or thinking more deeply and looking at the bigger picture, one might have realised it, perhaps.
So you think a lot of the people who say that they knew that a war was coming are talking with the benefit of hindsight, really?
I think that they are. There's so many people right now, it was obvious that war was coming. But I don't think that people did feel that. I think after Munich, a tremendous number of people really believed Chamberlain, you know, peace in our time. And there was certainly a tremendous sense of relief in the army as well. I didn't think the army wanted to go to war at all.
What was the estimate of you and your brother officers about the fighting capacity of the Italians at the time you were in Egypt?
Not very high, I don't think. I don't think not particularly high insofar as their personal qualities concerned, but on the other hand, I think we realised they'd gotten a very much larger army than we had available in Egypt, and they had some some good aircraft too, better than we had. You see, we had very elementary aircraft. I think the two squadrons at Ismailia had Hawker Hearts, which were biplane day bombers, the top speed of about 180 miles an hour, something like that, and fighters, like we had gladiators, but there weren't any gladiators in Egypt. They were up in Palestine at the time. Well, they hadn't arrived, I don't think. That's right, they hadn't arrived. And so really, whereas the Italian had a good dive bomber and day bomber in the Breeder 65 and aircraft like that, which I think we probably had an awful quite a job in dealing with, and lots of them in Benghazi and backed up in Tripoli and so on. I think we would have had a job to stop them, I think, in those days. I don't know. I don't really know enough about thinking back. I don't know really enough about the relative strength, except that in numbers of personnel, we were obviously very much smaller.
How had the Italian performance in Abyssinia affected your thinking about their military capacity?
Well, I think that there was a certain amount of sort of levity about it, because in fact, of course, they got a very bloody nose to begin with, and it was only later on that they managed to sort of struggle through, and even then, I don't think they really subdued the country. It's a very difficult country, indeed. And of course, there was a lot of fuss made at the time about the bombing civilians, you know, and the usual sort of propaganda put out about. I think, in fact, they were accused of using gas at one time. And I remember they were quite clearly, whether they did or not, I don't know. Whether they were accused of using mustard gas, I think. Whether they did or not, I don't know. But this was put out at the time. And one felt a sort of general antipathy towards them for doing this. But it was rather at the end of the line. You see, movement was so slow in those days. You didn't travel by air, or very rarely. So everything was done sort of slow time by sea.
Coming on next to... Coming on next to the everyday life of the officer in Egypt... Mm. How did you spend, you and your brother officers, spend your spare time there?
Well, very much the same as in any other cantonment in India or any other British any other British colony or dominion which the army was based, you had a garrison, an officer's club. It was called the United Service Club or something like that. It was down on Lake Maresca, and that was a sort of social centre for some people. And swimming, I suppose, and for some sailing, and for some tennis, and for the evening, you know, sort of, I suppose, going out and having a drink and sort of maybe there's a dance once a week at the club or something like that. It's all very slow time, and not, but it was fine, it suited us, it was the way we lived at the time. We didn't want to, we didn't know about raving it up in any other way, so it suited us. But there was one great asset about Ismailia, and that was the Canal de Suez Company. This was the French, because you see the French ran the Suez Canal, in spite of the fact Disraeli was wise enough to ensure that our investment in it was very high. In fact, it was run by the French, and there were a lot of senior, and the headquarters one of the headquarters was in Ismailia, and there were a lot of very nice French families there, and there was a French club, which was in fact much nicer than the, much more fun than the services club, and they had this very nice bathing beach, the plage down at Ferry Point, which was much more fun than the swimming pool they had at the services club. And certainly myself and two or three of my fellow subalterns spent all our, and of course there were quite a lot of French girls as well, to meet. Well, there were very few English girls there, one or two families, most of them were schooled in England probably, or the sort of, you know, grown up age. And we used to have great fun there. But don't get away again with the idea that we sort of raved up, because in fact the actual disciplines, the social disciplines on the French were quite sort of, in Napoleonic, I can't, or Third Empire or something, they were terribly strict. I mean, you weren't allowed out with a girl alone. You went out in company. Some families that had, I remember one family had lost their mother quite recently, and they were in mourning. They were white the whole time, all of them, not black, they were white, all the family, there were six or seven children in the family. And they were white, and they were not allowed to go to dances. They were very restricted in what they were allowed to do, and this was a 6 months, I forget the French name for it, a 6 months imposition, or whatever you call it, a 6 months. So they were restricted in this way for 6 months, that family, and they were a joint family with about four girls and four boys, I think, or three boys. So it was really there, it was great fun. It was, you know, it was a very restricted sort of fun, but we enjoyed it because we didn't expect anything else.